Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coin sale, bro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Guzu Saba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth a crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movement for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Fuck coins, hell bro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, and that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Look, my nigga, this is dedication. This is anti-hesitation. This is a real nigga celebration. This is a Don Black declaration. 59th and 5th Ave, granny house with vanilla wafers. This the remedy to separation. Tupac of my generation. Blue pill in the fucking matrix. Red rose in the great pavement. Young black nigga trapped and he can't change it. Know he a genius, he just can't claim it. Cause they left him no platform to explain it. He frustrated so he get faded. Like deep down inside he know you can't fail. How long should I stay dedicated? How long till opportunity meet preparation? I need some real nigga reparation. Or I run up in your bank just for recreation. Dedication, hard work, plus patience. And some more of my sacrifice, I'm done waiting. I'm done waiting, told you that I wasn't playing. Now you hear what I've been saying. Dedication. Dedication.
Love.
Spent my whole life thinking out the box. Boxing homies 3-on-1, got DP, but I ain't dropped. Trip on me, here I come. Spin around the block, they broke on me. Said I ran a stop sign, but that's a lie. I spent my whole life staring at the stage, playing Sega, daddy smoking Sherm, mama playing spades, catching papers. Grandma said I'd get some Jordan for my grades, that's my baby. When she died, my heart broke 100 ways. I spent my whole life trying to make it, trying to chase it. The cycle of a black man divided, trying to break it. You take a lost shit, don't cry about it, just embrace it. Minor setbacks for major comebacks, that's my favorite. My nigga L said you do a song with Nip, K-Dot he a better grip. I said he a man first, you hear the words out his lips. Without flourishing from the streets to black businesses. Level 4 yard living, given to false imprisonment. Listen close, my nigga, it's bigger than deuces and foes, my nigga. Since elementary, we close, my nigga, you're straight like that. I give you the game, go back to the turf and give it right back. For generations, we've been dealt bad hands with bad plans. Prove your dedication by hopping out Grand Am. I'm at the premiere, politicking with Top Nip and Snoop. Damn, clock watching the way we move. Dedication.
If it ain't congratulating, it looks like hate. If it ain't congratulating, it looks like what
Nip say. Hold up. This ain't entertainment, it's four niggas on the slave ship. These songs just the spirituals I swam against them waves with. Ended up on shore to their amazement. I hope the example I set's not contagious. Lockers behind gates but can't tame us. Used to be stay safe, now stay dangerous. Cause ain't no point playing defense, nigga. That's why I dove off the deep end, nigga, without a life jacket. Couple meals for the world, all my life cracking. Cook the books, bring it back, so it's no taxes. Royalties, publishing, plus our own masters. I'd be damned if I slave with some white crackers. I was mapping this out, I hit the heights backwards. Topping out the 85 and Reebok classics. Read a couple marathons just to get established. To make it happen, you got to have it. Dedication, hard work, plus patience. To some more of my sacrifice, I'm done waiting. I'm done waiting, told you that I wasn't playing. Now you hear what I've been saying. Dedication. Dedication. Ah! Ah!
Malcolm Garvey Huey, study Malcolm Garvey Huey. His life was like a movie, study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey, Malcolm
Garvey Huey.
His life was like a movie.
I organize,
everything I do's revolutionize. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these, really think you should. I study Malcolm Garvey Huey, Malcolm Garvey Huey. Marcia Cody with the Uzi, listening to Fela Kuti. I'm a goon with the machete, especially if it's deadly. Got the Santos for the Hexy to protect me, so respect me. This is heavy, legendary, revolutionary. My wifey, she resurrect me when they thought they had me buried. Took me out the cemetery, now it's family over every. Cause that's all that's necessary to avoid the commissary. I'ma live for you five, so I stop getting high. If you know, then you recognize. It's that black and brown pride, it's the power of the mind. RBG, God divine, you can see through the lies if you can read between the lines. I live, I die, I organize. Everything I do revolutionize. I build what's good for the whole damn hood. Study G's like these, really think you should. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Bungie Bobby packing Tukey. Sitting by the door so you can say I'm acting spooky. Just like in the movie, son, you better pack your toolie. Niggas switch, be acting fruity or be cracking like they pooky. Rather smoke a doobie than be burning and eluding. Bang bang, pig shooting, we should blame Rudy Julie. Yanny for the camera, shine a white and nose candy. Let you banging on the system, you a gangster wearing panties. RBG my family from the Bronx to Miami. Police cannot stand me, Pacquiao like a Manny. Call me little Bobby Hutton, cause I'm first to push the button. Rappers don't be saying nothing to the system, we say fuck them. This is for Nahanda, mama see mama Akua. All the real OGs, I'm a soldier cause you told me study Malcolm Garvey Huey.
What?
Malcolm Garvey Huey.
What?
Malcolm Garvey Huey. I'm reporting in the duty.
sticky icky, yours truly here for duty. Don DeVino, M.A. Uno, you know how we drop the jury. This is real, not a movie, not Mickey Donald Goofy. I'm a soldier, I avoid a bitch nigga like the cooties.
School face in a hoodie.
Fresh pair of khakis, we could do this like we fam. I go to war like the Apache for whatever. I stay ready, I learned that in Tallahassee. Baba Toon, they used to school me as a juvie, skipping classes. Never let the system use me. My duty is my passes. Watch the homies in your army, they don't always show they badges. Keep your family living healthy. Teach your children about they blackness. Teach your wifey how to use the ratchet. This shit is classic. Get your food, clothes, and shelter. Fuck your system, pimp it backwards. I ain't hating, I'm just saying, if you wanna be a rapper, study
Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey, study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey, study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey, study Malcolm Garvey Huey. Malcolm Garvey Huey.
A tactical approach is designed to get certain.
Here we are. Here we are. Right here is for the people.
Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep on and all of a sudden you are there in the Indiana Jones. And I keep all the gold and keep all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and it's all that we'll ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like we'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them two can defeat and them could have never clown. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
Yeah. Sabali, patience. What the old folks told me. Can you get with that? Discovering a world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhyme. Gets no realer.
We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was plastic, you went too far, you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again, everybody would have started off. The average man can't prove up most of the things that he chooses to speak of. And still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Call us teaching universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose start running. And the rich get fixed up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you resign? Can you restart? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows? Even though you drive cars, can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers, people that's just ignorant. You're scared of the truth.
Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it and try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruining. Trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. I'm fearless, I'm fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier, 10-7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Savali. Patience. Yeah.
You are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father you will do. He was a murderer from the beginning. He abode not in the truth, because there's no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, Jesus said, he's a liar and the father of the lie. And Jesus said that his word had no place in the Jews. Read John, starting with the 8th chapter, starting with the 31st verse. Down, down to the 44th verse. And when I say Jesus up here, I'm not talking about no blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pale-skinned, buttermilk complexion, white Jesus. I'm talking about a black Jesus that the Bible says would have nappy hair, and his body would be like burnt bronze or brass, as though it had been burnt in an oven. Give the white man his white Jesus back, put it in the garbage can, set it out on the corner, and let the garbage man pick it up and take it to the garbage dump. It's a form of spiritual genocide, a form of mental genocide and Holocaust. 40 to 50 million Holocaust survivors still in the death camps of America, still in the ghettos of America, still robbed of our names with Harry McGillicuddy, Jim Dandy O'Houlihan, Abraham Lincoln Culpepper, Hattie Mae Hamburger with lettuce and tomatoes on the side. Robbed completely of a knowledge of ourselves, nor the people in the annals of time have been so robbed and spoiled. The Bible said these are a people who are robbed and spoiled. They are snared in holes and hidden in prison houses. But we must rise up like Ra. Rise up like Ra. And take on a new life and take on a new birth. I say I criticize the Pope. I don't have any respect for the Pope. The hell you mean I called him a cracker? So damn what? The Pope don't like me. The Pope does not respect my leader and teacher, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. He has no respect for the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he is one of the perpetrators in our genocide and our current condition. You offer an apology? We're sorry. Everybody else gets reparation. Damn Jews get over 70 billion, over 100 billion. But you offer us an apology. We are so sorry. No. Use your influence to get reparations for us. Use your influence to ease the debt that is strangling and choking the life out of African nations from the World Bank and the IMF and the other IMFs. You say, and this is the first time you heard from me on this, and I think you should, at a Black Holocaust observance. Will you call for the death of the men, the women, the children, and the babies? Hell, you had heard that here at Howard University long before King College. Killing our men, our women, our children, and our babies in South Africa have killed them over a long period of time. And so I call for my people to stand up and fight back. And you have a problem with that? And because I said that we don't owe the white man nothing in South Africa. We give him 24 hours to get out of town by Sunday. I don't respect the process. I don't respect the elections process. You don't break in my damn house, bum rush my house, black boot stomp my door down, and then one day I gain the power to take my house back, and now we're going to hold a vote. And I'm so silly, you take the west wing of the house, you can take this wing over here, and any time a dispute comes up here, we will vote on it. One person in this house, one vote. That's a fool. No compromise in South Africa. We don't compromise with the white man in South Africa. You couldn't take America and then turn around and expect the white man to share it with you. Hell, he won't even share it with us. When he promised us 40 acres and a mule in 1866 and then turned around and Andrew Johnson vetoed him. No Jew in here has to live under the yoke of bondage and oppression that we still live under and have lived under for the past 500 years. The first president of these United States, these United Snakes, I didn't call it that. Benjamin Franklin used to write in the newspaper, the flag, one of the early flags was a snake for America. When the Union was split, the snake was split up, and they talked about uniting the Union and putting the snake back together. So, and they said, don't tread on me. That was on your flag, white man. So I call you the United Snakes of America. Because that's exactly what it is. As I near my conclusion here, at the Jewish Holocaust Memorial, they talked about books that were a part of the education system under Hitler, and talked about a little book called The Poison Mushroom. Well, hell, we got a book called Little Black Sambo. You telling me about a damn poison mushroom? Little Black Sambo. Dick and Jane were white. The milkman was white. The mailman was white. Huh? The fireman was white. The policeman was white. Mama was white. Daddy was white. The only one that had any black was Spot, and he was black and white. You got the little poison mushroom, but we got Little Black Sambo and many other books that poison the minds of black people here in the hells of North America. I have a few more points here, and we should be able to close out. We remember Emmett Till. We remember Cheney. We remember the Scottsboro Boys, as they called it. We remember the churches that were bombed then, and your plot to bomb churches even today. We remember the Sunday school lesson in the church in Alabama being the love that forgives when you bomb the church. We witness De La Beckwith, who killed Evers, who killed Medgar Evers, Brother Medgar Evers, and how long it took the so-called wheels of justice to finally get around because his widow, Sister Murley, didn't give up. But it's not justice for De La Beckwith to go to prison. When we become a free and independent people, the only solution to the De La Beckwith case would be that De La Beckwith would be to be dead. That's the only way we can say that the blood of Medgar Evers is satisfied. We remember Birmingham. We remember Montgomery, Alabama. We remember the vicious dogs, and they showed this at the Jewish Holocaust Memorial, but we remember the vicious dogs that would actually leap into the chest of our women during these civil rights marches and bite their breasts off, leap up into the groins of a black man and actually with sharp teeth bite his reproductive, regenerative organ off. Yes. We remember your cattle prods and your water hoses turning the water pressure loose on us. No Holocaust greater than this one. Don't even try it. Brothers and sisters, after all of these lies, you deserve a break today. You deserve a break today. The white man has a frequent liar program. There's a frequent liar program, and he's always going to lie. But we must now document our own history. And as Dr. John Henry Clark has warned us, that we are the only people who have no monuments, no memorials set up.
He said that the policeman is God. That's what he said. There's a devil saying that the policeman is God. He's judge, jury, and executor. Huh? Right on the spot. He talked about how he used to beat black men and women and Chicano brothers and sisters until he would just beat the waste out of them, beat the mess out of them. He said, then you could smell the niggas in the You could smell the Mexicans or the Chicano. You could smell them. I mean, you could smell them stinking. He said you couldn't get into the jail for the stench coming from them. They just beat them until they urinate on themselves. Beat them until their bowels would waste all over. He said he'd grab them and just throw them down the steps. Just throw them down. And another cracker down at the other end of the steps or catch them at the other end of the steps. Kick them and beat them. No, you got to stop. I'm here to tell you that the only way you're going to stop police brutality is you got to stand up and be brutal with this damn beast. You got to step to this cracker or it will never stop. You can moan, you can groan, you can sing, you can pray. You can recite, you can claim you know all the Quran, Old Testament, all the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran from Al-Fatiha to Al-Nas. You can know all the Medunete. You can know Maya, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, reciprocity. You can name those of the Netter system. You can go and study the Odu text and substantiate your position according to Odu. You can study the Ifa, or the Word, or the Akan, or the Yoruba, and run through the pantheon of the Orisha. You can call on Oludumare. You can call on Ilegba, and Shango, and Obatula, and Oshun, and Ogun, and Yemonya. You can know all of that. But unless you're willing to stand up and step to this white man, we will never get out of this condition. Frederick Douglass said the limits of a tyrant is prescribed by exactly how far you will let that tyrant go. He won't stop if you don't stop him. It's like any bully. The bully will keep picking on you until you get him to raise up off of you. But some of us will lose our lives. Tupac is gone already. Biggie is gone already. Many of us, Yusuf Hawkins is gone already. Many of us are already dead and we're dying every day. And while we're here in Queens tonight, black men and women and young black boys are dying at the hands of some cracker somewhere in America right now. I would rather die for a cause than to die because you in some barroom pinching somebody's wife on the booty on the bar stool and get your throat cut with a Miller Lite Miller Lite bottle. It's a hell of a life, man. That's a hell of a way to go. Say, your daddy got killed. Say, yeah. How'd he get killed? Say, he pinched somebody's wife on the booty at the bar stool. The dude picked up a Miller Lite bottle of Budweiser Light and broke it and cut his throat. Is that the way he died? Well, he died in the East Coast, West Coast fight.
East Coast? West Coast?
You a damn fool. You'll die over some bullshit? Some damn records? A damn CD? You are what you call a recording studio gangster? Oh, you bad as hell in the recording studio. Ain't a nigga in the world badder than you. Capone couldn't mess with you. Babyface Nelson. None of them couldn't mess with you. A recording studio gangster. You just as bad as you can be. You gon' blow, put your gat in the nigga's mouth and blow the nigga's brains out. I'll stomp that hoe. I'll kick that bitch. White man show up, you can hear a rat pee on cut. Nigga ain't ready to fight. Nigga ain't ready to fight. I say we must arm the masses. Most of y'all got guns anyway. You shoot them for the 4th of July. Damn day that ain't even your Independence Day. Yes, you do. You shoot them on New Year's and New Year ain't in yet. You just got them. They're just toys. Or you'll go get them on your wife. Draw the gun on her because she burnt the beans for the 4th time. She'll just go order some beans. Or she'd draw the pistol on you because the phone rang at 2 in the morning and you stayed on too long, talking too low. Two or three brothers, so bad. I'm Crip. Two or three brothers, so bad. I'm Blood. They'll go off into territory of their rival brother gang and face bumper jacks, face chains, baseball bats, pipes, nines, AKs, face everything in a fratricidal war with your kith and kin, your flesh and blood, your brother, your sister. Damn white man come, you throw the guns under the damn car, throw the damn guns in the bushes, he make 50 niggas spread up against the wall, one peck of wood. All right, get up against the wall, buddy. Don't move, guy. Here's Will Kill Johnson. Here's Bloody Blood, all them crazy names you got. Here's Shotgun. All of them spread up against the wall.
Those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And I have to say that because we got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists, and robbers, and killers, and murderers, and imperialists, and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society, a society that engages in black in white on black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell often the psychology of an individual or people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is its inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages on white, on black violence, because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence, because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a crimogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white on black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the reconstructions. It breached its contracts of the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contracts in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engaged in Klan terrorism, which it still engaged in today. It engages in race riots where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white on black violence because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes its justice system an instrument of injustice, when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries, so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor racketeering when it runs black men away from its construction sites, when we go into a black community where housing is supposedly being made and built for black residents, and we see few, if any, black men building those houses. And when those black men come to work on those sites, they are chased away by the police and the construction workers. And when they are chased away and made to stand on the corners, then they are accused of refusing to work and desiring not to work. We accuse this society of being a crimogenic society, of being a criminal organization, of being an organization that engages in chronic white-on-black violence, when it engages in drug trafficking, when it imports the drugs that poisons our neighborhoods and destroys the consciousness of our people, destroys their health. We see a criminogenic people from way back engaging in the selling of opium to the Chinese and in engaging in opium wars. We see this drug trafficking group of people engaging in alcohol addiction when they used it to destroy Indians, when they used it to destroy African chiefs who, under the influence of the alcohol, often signed away their peoples and their nations. We accuse it of drug addiction and drug trafficking when it traded guns for drugs to carry on its warfare in Central and South America. We accuse it of being a criminal nation, a criminal people, a criminal nation, a crimogenic society, when it engages in gun running across the world, when it sells the very weapons that will be used to destroy its own sons and daughters. We accuse it of criminality when it acts to maintain an evil military-industrial complex.
So it's beautiful to listen to our children talk about the African Union, the model African Union. But I ask you children to take it deep, a little bit further. It doesn't end with just a conversation about corruption in Africa. The bigger corruption in Africa is coming from outside. Try flying low over the DRC. You're going to see tarmacs in the middle of the jungle. You're going to see 747s flying into the DRC, picking up minerals and flying right outside the country. Do you think those multinationals are going to want to see peace in the DRC? Do you think they're going to want to see peace in South Sudan? No. A stable Africa is an Africa that cannot be exploited. So they will see to it that there will never be peace in Africa by any means necessary unless you come to the table and do something about it. For a continent that doesn't have a single gun manufacturing company, we simply have endless supply of guns. How? How is this okay that Africa continues to be exploited to this extent? How is it okay that the world has watched as France is taking cold, hard cash out of Africa? How is this okay? I want to know. United Nations, answer that. Secretary General Guterres, answer that. When you all meet every year in New York, what are you talking about? That is our reality as black people. And only we can change that. Yes. I am very encouraged by the president of Benin. He has put in a formal request. That's right. for all the bank reserves his country has deposited with France. So to France I say, we are watching you, France. There better not be a coup in Benin, because that is your modus operandi. There better not be any instability in Benin, because that is your modus operandi. I'm hoping that the rest of the West African countries, quote-unquote, former French colonies, can also demand a refund of their deposits. Africa is on the move. Let's join hands. Let's support those countries in what they have started. And since I'm standing here in a historical black college, that education and understanding is start with you, our youth. This is a fight that I know very well that we will not be able to finish. But golly, we want to make sure that you understand fully what is going on. So when we pass the baton, you understand the issues. No more shall we continue to be ignorant. Our eyes are open. We know our Africa. We are going to reconnect with our roots. African Americans, you must understand there is a void that is deep in each and everyone's subconscious. It is a void that affects everything you do. First, you must understand you have that void. In this country, with the exception of the American Indians, everybody is a foreigner. And everybody has their roots outside the United States. And the rest of the races are connected to their roots, with the exception of the African Americans. You're too busy running away from your roots. You're busy denying who you are. Well, guess what? It is what it is. You are an African. And Africa is home. And the sooner you wake up and realize and accept that Africa is home, the sooner you are going to fill that void. For as long as that voice is in you, you're always going to be like a ship without an anchor. The wind blows this way, here you go. The wind blows the other way, here we go. Find your base. Go home. Africa is where you belong. And Africa is where your roots are. Thank you. But as I began to make a diagnosis, I analyzed the situation, and my final assessment was that the ignorance that the world has about Africa is the disease that I must fight. So I set out to have a plan, and I began implementation. Because it is only when that disease is treated, it is only then and only then can we embark on a true healing path for Africa and her children. I'm going to ask you one question. If I were to ask you right now, all of you, what color is the devil? I want you to answer that question to yourself. And I'm going to pause for 2 seconds. Let me guess. Most of you said black, didn't you? And then I'm going to ask you another question. What color are the angels? Let me guess. Most of you said white. Who has seen either? And yet we accept it. So you take a group of people, you say the color black is associated with the devil, everything bad is black, you wear black to go to funerals, the villains in the movies are black, everything undesirable is black. You take a group of people and say, you too are black. No matter how we try as black mothers to raise our children at home and tell them you're black and you're beautiful, the minute they step foot outside that door, they are immersed in nothing but negativity about that which they represent. How do you raise a child with good self-esteem in such a world? Then I took it back a step further. So growing up in my village in Zimbabwe, the British did not come to Zimbabwe until 1896. prior to that, we had our own gods that we worshipped. We had spirit mediums who were our intermediaries to the higher power. They had no color until the British arrived. Then the British began to, you can remember the missionaries were sent to Africa to teach us how to read, but not how to reason. So we're programmed to receive that which they wanted us to receive. And so one of the things they taught us was the issue of black and white. Remember, like 1896, in my country, we did not have those colors. And I was not referred to as black. I was African. But somehow we were just told that you're black. And then the other race is white. And then the other race, you take white color, you say white is pure, the angels are white, you wear white to go to weddings, you wear white for christening, and then you take another group of people and say you're white. So the children are raised that you're beautiful, everything that you represent is perfect, and when they step outside the door, the world validates what they are being told at home. Now you take these two children. One is surrounded by nothing but negativity about that which they represent. The other is surrounded by nothing but positivity about that which they represent. How do you expect these children to look at themselves as equal? These are some of the subliminal messages that are being passed on to our children. And in my own assessment, and when you look at it from the African point of view, it explains why some of our leaders, people who are supposed to represent us, when they sit across the table with others who don't look like them, they automatically feel inferior. It is a serious problem. It affects our ability to feed our children as mothers. It affects our ability to provide for our children to go to school, provide good healthcare systems, provide good infrastructure. It starts right there. The failure to stand up and defend that which you believe in and defend that which is blatantly wrong. 1884. After the colonizers had been running around our continent of Africa, they wondered how they were going to defeat these people. You see, you got to understand, before the Greek civilization, before the Roman Empire, there was Africa. The pyramids were built 2,500 years before the Greek civilization. Have you ever wondered why the Greek philosophers, the mathematicians, where were they sent for training, for education, for retraining? They were sent to Africa. Why were they sent to Africa? Because civilization as we know it began in Africa. Civilization was in Africa before they had it in Europe. You see, the history books choose to begin history from here going forward. What they don't tell you is that even the English language is based on the Yoruba language. Humanity, as we know it, began in Africa. Without the African, there would not be any other races. It's just a simple fact. So they came together and set out a plan. Prior to 1884, you got to remember, Africa was made up of powerful kingdoms. The countries that we know as African countries today did not exist. So if you're going to be doing your DNA testing, I urge you, don't settle for "I'm from Nigeria." Settle for "what is my kingdom?" She said, "I'm a proud member of the Mono Mutapa kingdom." Are you an Ashanti? Are you from the Benin Kingdom? That's who we were before the Berlin Conference. So why did they meet in 1884 at the invitation of the then Chancellor of Germany, Bismarck? Bismarck said, let's all come together. We, the colonizers. Because keep in mind, at that time, they were beginning to fight each other over how to distribute what they had looted from the Africans. So you see, the French would loot from the Africans, then the British would come and then loot from the French, while the French had looted from the Africans, and then the Belgians would come, they would loot from the British, while the British looted from the French, then the French looted from the Africans. They were getting ready to have a European war on the African soil. So Bismarck called his sidekick, the then King of Belgium, and said, let's meet in Berlin. Let's strategize on how we can effectively loot from the Africans in a unified way that does not lead us into a war. So they met in Berlin to strategize on how to see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated and dominated. Make no mistake about that. I repeat, they met in Berlin from November of 1884 to February of 1885 to strategize on how to effectively see to it that Africa and her children are forever defeated and dominated. That was 135 years ago. Fast forward 2019. The strategy remains in place today. History tells us that they sat across from big old map of Africa. They proceeded to chop Africa up into tiny little economies that we see today. Tiny economies that clearly cannot survive on their own. Tiny economies that should they survive, like black people always do, they're easy to destabilize. And then after they chopped up these little countries, they often say the divisions were so arbitrary that husband and wife were in bed, and when they woke up in the morning, the husband was in Zambia and the wife was in Malawi. And the assignments of these countries to the colonizers were also done in a way that they would provide maximum destruction. I often say, have you ever pictured driving from Zambia? You're speaking English. Pretty soon, you're in Angola. You're speaking Portuguese. A little north, you're in DRC. You're speaking French. Go a little west, you're in Equatorial Guinea. You're speaking Spanish. A little further north, you're in southern Cameroon. You're speaking English. Keep going north. Now you're in northern Cameroon, you're speaking French. A little west, now you're in Nigeria, you're speaking English. You see, give it a couple of generations, people who were once one will not know each other because they now speak a different language. They now have borders. They now have a different flag, and each one with their own anthem. People who were once one, completely divided up. It was all by design. Then they take those little economies and give them the same sovereignty on the world stage as the big boys. How do you take Central African Republic and put Central African Republic on the same stage with China and say negotiate? How do you take Malawi and put Malawi in the same room across from India and say negotiate? How do you take Djibouti and put them in the same room with the United States and say negotiate? Africans are defeated before the game even begins. I often use an example of taking my poor husband, if you knew him, and put him in the same boxing ring with Mike Tyson. He said, my husband will collapse before he even gets on the stage. And when he collapses, it's like, what's wrong with you, Dr. Carl? Can't you fight Mike Tyson? The world is not fair. So when we find ourselves being thrown, oh, African leaders are corrupt. Oh, that's a big one. They will hit you with that every time. And every time it's supposed to be a conversation stopper about Africa. You see, after they divided us up into the tiny little economies that we are today, then between 1958 and 1961, they started giving us quote-unquote independence. France did something absolutely deplorable. Made the former, and I'm going to use the word former loosely, French colonies, because they still are colonized, signed a document which they called the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. Dig this. On one hand, we're giving you your independence. But on the other hand, sign this document that you are agreeing to continue to be colonized. So two countries said, no way, Jose, we ain't doing this. Guinea and Mali. The French could not understand it. How could an African country dare not want to be affiliated with France? So in their anger, history tells us that they went into those two countries, took everything that they thought they had brought. To hear Mugabe put it, they even took the last teaspoon and the last chair, proceeded to pour concrete into the sewage pipes, completely devastating the two economies. This was also done as a way of letting the other countries know that should you refuse to sign this document, this is the fate that awaits you. So the rest of the country signed. Fast forward, 2019, the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization remains in place. What is special about this? The Pact for the Continuation of Colonization said, one, you Africans, you do not know how to manage your money. You shall deposit 85% of your bank reserves with the French Central Bank under the control of the French Minister of Finance. The French government will take all your monies, collectively invest your monies in the French stock market under the French name. And you don't have to know what the returns are. Should you wish to access some of your money, keep in mind that countries are now left with only 15% of their reserves. You have to submit your country's financial report. And if approved, you get to access up to 20% of your deposits from the previous year as a loan at commercial interest rates. I'm going to repeat that. Should you want to access some of your own money, you have to submit your own country's financial report. And if approved, you get it as a loan at commercial interest rate. So you go from having a humongous credit with France to now owing France for borrowing your own money, a loan that you'll never be able to finish paying. They also said, all your minerals discovered and yet to be discovered, French companies have the first right of refusal. You go to those countries today, all major contracts, French companies have the first right of refusal. The water supply, the power supply, the mining fixtures, the oil rigs, road construction, airports, French companies have the first right of refusal. If anything is left, the people in your country may get it. They also said, your military can only be trained by France. You can only purchase military equipment from France. France shall have military presence in your country and can invade your country without notice if France feels that her interests in your country are being violated. What constitutes a violation? If you decide to pull from the pact. Keep in mind, as part of the financial situation, France also created a special currency just for West African countries and Central African countries that is called a CFA. And that France is the only country that can print your money. So a violation would constitute an African leader saying, I no longer want my money printed by France. I'm going to start printing my own money. That's a violation, and it can call for France invading your country. In the past many years, we've had 67 coups in Africa out of 26 countries. Of the 26 countries, the coups, 16 coups, were 16 countries were former French colonies. To date, 22 African leaders were assassinated during a coup, documented all of them. France was behind it, simply because France felt they were quote-unquote threatening French interests by wanting to pull out of this horrible, horrible pact. 2019, nothing has changed. Countries are still depositing their funds to France. French companies still have first right of refusal. So if you are an African president, newly appointed, your first day in office, your chief of staff comes to you and reads to you the do's and don'ts as stipulated by the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization. Mr. President, you have given up your financial resources. You've given up control of your natural resources. You've given up your military. What power do you have? May I take you back to the question? When people start the conversation with corruption in Africa, I give it to you. I'm not disagreeing. We have corruption in Africa. But who doesn't have corruption on earth? Which country, which continent, which region is free of corruption? And yet what happens in Africa, so much light is shone on it. And when the same thing happens elsewhere, it's minimized. You see, I liken to today, because of the Pact for the Continuation of Colonization, France alone, that little bitty country, is taking out of Africa over $500 billion. Over $500 billion. And by the time they finish investing that money into the French stock market, they're realizing trillions of dollars in any given year. Pack that. The watchdogs for corruption are saying out of Africa, $50 billion gets out of the continent from corruption. Now you got two thieves. You have a thief with a briefcase with $50 billion and another thief, a small thief, with a briefcase with $500 billion. Which thief are you going to go after? The world wants you to be stuck with a thief with $50 billion and not the thief with $500 billion that's going to become trillions of dollars. Do you quickly realize how the $50 billion becomes a crumb under the table? And we are meant to fight each other for which one of the brothers has gotten a larger chunk under the table. So that way we never have to get on the table. And talk about not a three-course meal, not a 5-course meal, not a 10-course meal. I make it, I call it a 100-course meal going on the table. The question I have is, why has it been so difficult for us as Africans to say enough is enough? How long are we going to keep watching this carnage go on and we say nothing? It goes back to the mind. It goes back to that fear. It goes back to that sense of inferiority. And I go back to the diagnosis I made when I went to Washington. That until we black people understand that we are suffering from the legacy of colonization, that we are suffering from the legacy of slavery, that while we may have lost the shackles of the in our legs and our hands, the shackles of the mind continue. Until we realize that we are a wounded people and we need healing, nothing about our circumstances is going to change. We are sick people. But to be sick, first you must realize and accept that you're sick. How do you go to the doctor if you don't think you're sick? We are not only in the doctor's waiting room on an outpatient basis. We are not even in the hospital in a general ward. As black people, we are in the intensive care. And we need to realize that. United Nations. It is a body that's supposed to be the watchdog for human rights violations. France is on the UN Security Council. And you see me pick up on France. There are other colonizers too, who are still colonizing Africa. But France did something extraordinary through this pact. We're talking cold, hard cash out of Africa. That we must stop. And immediately, we must do that. So France remains as a member of the UN Security Council. And yet France today remains one of the biggest perpetrators of human rights violations in Africa. And everybody is giving it, the world is giving it a blind eye. France remains the biggest risk to peace and security in Africa today. And nobody is talking about it. So I decided that if I am going to deliver on my mandate.
The idea that you see involves more than just opening the eyes and exposing the retina to the environment. It means then, in a sense, the mind sees through the eyes and directs the eyes, is what to see. We, in hypnosis, we deal with something that we call sometimes negative hallucinations. That is, getting people, let's look at the other type of hallucination first, say the positive hallucination. The positive hallucination, of course, is getting people to see what is actually not there. To see things that are actually not present in reality. And of course, some of you probably have seen those kinds of hypnotic tricks where you tell the hypnotic patient or the client that he has a rabbit in his lap. And of course, there's nothing there, and he then proceeds to pet it and play with it, even though it's not there. This is what we call a positive hallucination. You can also produce a negative hallucination. You can tell the hypnotized subject that an object which is right before his face is not there. And he will see everything except that particular object that you've directed him not to see. You see this sometimes in certain forms of schizophrenia, for instance. Some types of schizophrenics can look and see everything on this podium here, except to have this tape, even though it's right there before their eyes. Sometimes it's fascinating when you look at people who are so-called mentally disturbed, particularly the schizophrenic, because you can see the enormous powers of the human mind. And in this instance, then, you have a mind that for some reason or other is instructing that patient not to see a particular object right before his face. And yet, he's seeing all of the other objects around it very, very clearly. So what we are trying to talk about here then is that if your mind and your brain is inefficiently programmed, then that inefficient program will misdirect your eyes, will misdirect your senses, will create for you then a reality that is, in a sense, unreal. It will mean then, since you are missing reality and missing parts of that reality, you cannot efficiently cope with it. To a good extent then, when we look at the history of the African man in relationship to the European, we see a man whose reality has been created for him, whose mind and brain has been created in such a way that even the most obvious things in reality are overlooked and not seen. And this is often done through what we call this so-called education. Remember, I alluded to the idea of trained eyes, experienced eyes, which means that an individual's mind has been created so that the eyes can find what that individual is looking for. What makes you think then that the European who trains your mind is going to train your mind to see reality in such a way that it will overthrow his dominance over you as a people? How do you expect to see reality from a people who writes your history in such a way that you don't even see yourself there? So when you look at history, you're not there. You look at American history, you're not there. You look at world history, you're not there. You look at anthropology, you're not there. And if you are there, you're there as a primitive Stone Age kind of people, never having written anything or contributed anything. You look at economics and you're not there except perhaps as a commodity in and of itself. You look at mathematics and you're not there. You look at every discipline and you do not see yourself. What kind of reality then can we be looking at as a people when our minds have been trained in such a way that we have literally negative hallucinations as well as positive hallucinations? It's amazing then that when we look at these disciplines where we don't see ourselves, so many of us call this kind of education in these disciplines a good education. It's an amazing kind of thing. You've had a people who have hung you, lynched you, degraded you, enslaved you, killed Indians, colonized people all over the world, killed millions and millions and millions of people, exploited people, destroyed people, polluted the earth, have done such a job on the earth until you begin to wonder if they come from the same planet. You begin to wonder if these people are not a type of infection, a virus whose purpose it is to destroy the health of the world itself. And as we see them now beginning to destroy the earth, and now getting ready to move their destructive natures into the cosmos itself. They've already made it to the moon and are now preparing to infect the whole of the universe. How can you then, as a people, assume that the people who've done all of these kinds of things to us as a people can give us a vision of reality? How can we accept their description of reality as the one with which we are going to guide our own behavior? How can we believe a people whose very lives depends upon our continuing domination? And yet there are those among us who seem to want to believe this, who seem to want to push their children under the instructorship of these people, who seem to want their people to resemble these people in some fashion, who have the nerve to see these people as representing some kind of civilization. These people may represent a culture, but not a civilization, particularly if we're going to look at the word civil in the sense that it is normally used. We saw this thing here. In fact, last week I remarked somebody had a conference here somewhere, and they voted against or they condemned terrorism. In fact, I saw Reagan, someone proposed that the meeting between Reagan and Gorbachev would involve a discussion of terrorism. And I found that so amusing. In fact, I find the newspapers and the TV, particularly the news, very, very amusing. And they're real jokes to watch. And in a way, you're looking at these guys and they're going to talk about terrorism. And yet, here are the world's two greatest terrorists sitting in conference. Two people in the world who have the world wondering, when is the end going to come? When is one of them going to go off and drop a bomb that is going to destroy the life of man and perhaps life on earth, period? The very fact that they are seen as powerful people, the very fact that the world sat in intense attention when they met, is symbolic of the fact that they are holding the world in a state of terror, and that we are frightened that they may, for some reason or other, let loose the great power that they have under their hands. And yet they have nerve enough to talk about terrorism as if it belongs to another people. And yet these are the people many of us want to claim that we want our children to be just like. These are the people we want our children to share a piece of the pie with. And yet these are the peoples whose very weapons are weapons of death. These are the people who represent death in the world. One of the things I recognized when I went through the graduate schools, and that struck me again and again and again, and that was this idea that these people are dead. They're not alive. And dead people are deadly. What kind of civilization can it be when the more civilized you become, the more deadly you become? How can you justify that as civilization? We as a people then have to recognize that there must be an alternative to this kind of being, that the idea of our people is not to share equality with these people. because the system that they represent is one that in and of itself should be rejected. What kind of education, and the brother wonders sometimes why I don't want to be called doctor, or I don't want to be called this and that. In a sense, I think if we think about it very closely, we should be very hesitant about giving ourselves those titles that are conferred upon us by these other people and what they so-called represent. Because we have to recognize that the educated individual is the craziest of all individuals. That the educated individual is the most dangerous of all individuals. When this world comes to its end, it will not be brought to an end by the muggers on the streets, ladies and gentlemen. It will not be brought to an end by the drug addicts, by the street prostitutes, by the youth gangs. It's going to be brought to an end by people with PhD degrees. It's going to be brought to an end by people who studied physics and mathematics, who spent 15 and 20 and 30 years in school. It's going to be brought to an end by people who live in nice clipped lawns with houses on the corner, with neat hedges, two-car garages, nice little well-spoken children, the people who send their kids to private school. And one morning they'll go off to work and give their wives a nice little bourgeois kiss. And then they'll go down and sit in front of the console of their computer and proceed to blow themselves up along with the rest of the world. What kind of education is it that leads to these kind of people, ladies and gentlemen? These people are being educated into madness. A real Afrocentric education would not educate people in such a way that they then develop tools of death and destruction, that they become the endpoint of a destructive procedure. When you must recognize then that these very people you bow and dip to and defer to, these very so-called experts, are the people who are going to take you directly to hell. Because you are responding to them not in terms of truth, not in terms of what they're really saying, but in terms of their symbols of authority. And because they lay these symbols of authority on you, they can tell you any kind of nonsense, and you're ready to believe it. And because they threaten you and intimidate you with their degrees and with their so-called learning, you're not willing to follow your own common sense and question what they have to say and where they're going and what they're doing. And you don't have sense enough then to say, wait a minute. If you were so well educated, if you were so liberal, if you were so perceptive, if you were so concerned, why are you making weapons of death that will destroy you, your children, and the futures of mankind? Why are you then living in the laps of luxury, having far more wealth and money than you could ever use, while millions and millions of my people are starving and dying the world over? So we must recognize then that these kind of people cannot lay a correct perception of reality upon us as a people. And we must recognize that the very educated among them are the very ones who are responsible to a great degree for creating the distorted reality we face today. We have to recognize that knowledge in and of itself does not represent the salvation of mankind. You saw this in the book of Genesis, didn't you? Where Adam and Eve were told to stay away from the tree of knowledge. And the old devil there was telling them, what? Eat of it. You should be as gods.
He's just telling you that.
If you get a hold of this, this fruit, you'll be able to know good as evil, and you'll see right around you. You can see just as good as God sees, and in a sense, you will become God yourself. And they ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. And from this point on, we see that knowledge was not the salvation of man. And you can see it today in the Caucasian who believes that the more knowledge he gets, the more somehow he's going to be able to be godlike. He thinks that if he gets to know more about DNA, he's going to be able to create life, and perhaps he will to a degree. But have you also noticed that the more knowledge he's gotten, the more of a danger he's become to the world? And that the more he's gotten to know about the atoms and the so-called foundations of the world, the more he has also gotten to know about how to create death and destruction. So consequently, he is in a race with himself, thinking that knowledge will save him, when all it does in most instances is push him closer and closer to the end of his life on earth. And so the Russians feel as if they knew a little more about the United States, a little more than the United States, then they would be able to defend themselves against the warlike nature of this country. And therefore they learn a little more and build a more dangerous weapon. And the United States then feels that it knows a little more than the Russians know, he will defend itself against their weapon. And they move a little closer to death and destruction. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it is a people who have been educated in terms of knowledge, but not in terms of the spirit. Not in terms of the heart, and not in terms of the soul. It is a knowledge that is dead and materialistic.
Not be deceived by this kind of thing, ladies and gentlemen. It is quite possible. Even if you don't think it's possible, you have to prepare for the what if. I've often mentioned to people about the Martin Luther King dream, you know, and he lays out the dream. It's a beautiful dream, I've remarked. But then that dream is also based on an if. You know, if they will love us, if they will accept us. And there are a lot of propositional statements in there. You know, if the economy is good and all of these kinds of things, then little black boys and white boys and girls may hold hands together. But we recognize that this is a propositional statement that's being made here. But you also have to ask the other question, what if it doesn't work this way? You see? What if the dream does not come true? Another problem we have often, we believe in the American mythology of progress. We as blacks have bought that idea. We bought this idea because America has advanced to some degree over time, and many of us have automatically assumed that things have got to get better. That's sort of the American way of thinking. You know, we got it today, it's got to be better tomorrow. There's no law that guarantees you in any way that things have got to get better, ladies and gentlemen. There's no universal rule that says life has to get better, that says race relationships have to get better, simply because you were in slavery some years ago and now you have a so-called relative degree of freedom. The idea then that you can never go back into slavery, or the idea that you can never re-experience Reconstruction and the other kinds of things. To think that this is not going to occur, there is no law in the universe that tells you that that this cannot be the case. There's also this belief in the invulnerability of the white man, and the belief that somehow he's going to always protect his interests and be able to advance his interests, and therefore, as long as we hang in.
When people discuss the issues in L.A., they want to discuss them only within the context of the time that these disturbances occurred. And they only want to discuss them in terms of the images of people running around in the street and destroying property within that context. One of the things that the ruling groups in this society always seeks to do is to control time, to control the use of time. And by confining then the discussion to the period of time of the disturbance, then the emphasis is on the actual behavior. And therefore the behavior is not placed within historical context, political and ideological context, and therefore is made to appear all the more irrational and purposeless. Often the events that precipitate a so-called riot or a so-called revolt appears to be somewhat minor, you see, and in and of itself not worthy of the kind of reaction that occurred. But this can only appear to be the case when one ignores the prior history of the disturbance. And one ignores the underlying emotional state, social and political and economic conditions that existed at the time of the disturbance. When one forgets then that the apparently minor occasion which precipitated the reactionary disturbance itself may have been symbolic of a particular set of historical circumstances and symbolic of a particular state of mind. Merely the straw that breaks the camel's back. Because as we say in Black on Black Violence, every act has a history. And it's in that history that we come to understand it. And therefore, we must resist the attempts of those on TV who interview us and so forth to confine the discussion to the mere behavior of the people during the time that that behavior occurred. And we ourselves must look at the history that occurred prior to the event, and more importantly, at the state of mind of the people who precipitated the event or were precipitated by events to engage in that behavior. The preconditions which set the stage, for the Los Angeles and urban revolts have a long history and are many. They include both socioeconomic conditions and the collective mental state of the African American community. Of the two, the mental state of anxiety and frustration over current and future developments, that state is the more important. It's not the concrete state as much as the perception of the state and the state of mind of a people. The dissatisfied state of mind and the attitudes of black people toward our conditions constitute the major factors which precede and underlie urban violence and revolt. So you can't look at the number of people who have achieved middle class status and so forth. You must look at the state of mind of our people and the level of dissatisfactions that exist in our minds as people. The preconditions for the LA revolt, of course, were many. And I'll just name a few of them. We don't have time to go through them all. Some of you might have had a chance to see or read the Atlantic magazine of May 1991. And you see here, of course, the issue of race was its cover story. When the official subject is presidential politics, taxes, welfare, crime, rights, or values, the real subject is race. We have old quail who can't tell the difference between potato and potato talking about traditional values. Another coded word for race, implying that black folk have no values, implying somehow that black mothers and fathers actually tell their children to go out and commit crime. Son, when I want you to grow up, I want you to be the biggest crack dealer on the block. That would just make me so happy. Be a criminal. Drop out of school. You know, what is this man talking about? What is he implying when he tries to imply that there's an absence of so-called values in the black community? Be very suspicious, by the way, of these people who talk about values anyway. We have to ask him, what kind of values did they have to make them rob and steal and destroy the Indians and the enslavement of black people? As I often said about Jimmy Swaggart when he used to talk about that old-time religion. He used to march across that stage with that Bible pumping up and down. Yes, talking about the religion of his great-grandpas and how he wanted that religion brought back. Of course, I have to remind my people, you really don't want that religion brought back. Because at the time they had that religion, they were hanging and lynching black people and enslaving black people. So I definitely don't want that old-time religion. And I'm a little weary about those traditional values he's talking about, too. Because those are apparently the values that underlie the racism of this nation and that rationalizes white supremacy and that somehow lays the ideological foundations for the mistreatment of African people in America. I am not concerned then about the restoration of their so-called traditional values, but the creation of new values. In this book and in this magazine by Thomas Byrne Edsall and Mary Edsall, they start out the article by stating, race is no longer a straightforward, morally unambiguous force in American politics. Instead, considerations of race are now deeply embedded in the strategy and tactics of politics. In competing concepts of the function and responsibility of government, and in every voter's conceptual structure of moral and partisan identity. We're at the very center and heart of how America defines itself. Race helps define the liberal and conservative ideologies, shapes the presidential coalitions of the Democratic and Republican parties, provides a harsh new dimension to concern over taxes and crime, drives a wedge through alliances of the working classes and the poor, and gives both momentum and vitality to the drive to establish a national majority inclined by income and demography to support policies benefiting the affluent and upper middle class. In terms of policy, race has played a critical role in the creation of a political system that has tolerated, if not supported, the growth of the disparity between rich and poor over the past 15 years. Race-coded images and language changed the course of the 1980, 1984, and 1988 presidential elections and the 1990 elections for the governorships of California and Alabama, the U.S. Senate in North Carolina, and the post of Texas Secretary of Agriculture. The political role of race is subtle and complex, requiring listening to those whose views are deeply repellent to some and deeply resonant for others. The debate over racial policy has been skewed and distorted by a profound failure to listen. And so we see here then that blacks are the scapegoats of this society. African Americans are the means by which this society defines itself. As I say it again on black violence, you see, that the whole of the white ego and the whole of the white self-image is built on its definition of who black people and African people are. That is why it is obsessed by criminalizing African people. Whenever you see a people insisting against all kinds of evidence on negating and scandalizing the personality of another person or another people, you recognize then that they're engaged in those acts to protect their own ego, and that their ego structure is built on maintaining the scandalizing of their targets. And that if they did not have these targets of scandal, if they did not have these egos, these people as scapegoats, their facade and their infrastructure would crumble and fall apart. They would come face to face with the madness and insanity that motivates their personalities and their systems. When blacks move out of our role as scapegoats and redefine ourselves in ways that cannot be denied by any people in the world, then white people will go crazy. And they will fall apart. And we said in Black on Black then that the so-called criminality of black people is an economic and political necessity for maintaining the system. It is not merely an accusation flowing from racial prejudice, nor merely accusation flowing from racial hatred, as hatred has little to do with it. It is necessary to the very foundations of the system itself. And that's why at the center of it, even in the current politics of the day, you will see African people. And how will you deal with African people as a determining factor in terms of who will get elected and who will be given power in this society? It determines who will be called liberal and who will be called conservative. It determines then the support that they will win in this system or will not win. And we have a situation here then where the Democratic Party, in the dastardly behavior of Clinton, is trying to change the perception that the white electorate has of it so that it can gain power by disrespecting black people and by creating bogus issues. And again, it has come to recognize, as is made very clear in this article, which basically lays out a program for the Democratic Party for achieving power in America, by saying you got to learn somehow to disentangle yourself from these black folk. Because in an analysis that you sponsored, a polling firm that you hired found the following. These white Democratic defectors, talking about those, what you call the Reagan Democrats, expressed a profound distaste for blacks, a sentiment that pervades almost everything they think about government and politics. Blacks constitute the explanation for their white defectors' vulnerability, and for almost everything that has gone wrong in their lives. Not being black is what constitutes being middle class. Not living with blacks is what makes a neighborhood a decent place to live. These sentiments have imparted implications for Democrats as virtually all progressive symbols and themes have been redefined in racial and pejorative terms. The special status of blacks is perceived by almost all of these individuals as a serious obstacle to their personal advancement. Indeed, discrimination against whites has become a well-assimilated and ready explanation for their status, vulnerability, and failures. So you see why we got to look at more than whether we've gotten an increase in jobs and whether more of us are in schools and so forth, because the attitudes that the other people are operating on have little or nothing to do with these sort of things. You read last week where the whites engaging in the buying of weapons is increasing at a faster rate than blacks. And whites engaging in violence is increasing 30% faster than blacks. And as I will talk a bit later on, this speaks to the fact that whites feel extremely vulnerable. They feel under threat. And this implies then that at some point these feelings may boil over into attacks on the black community. For the rationales have already been set. This situation where the election to political office, where gaining the reins of power depends upon one's relationship and attitude toward blacks, is very serious. It means then that blacks must be subjected to a constant barrage of innuendo and scandal. And that the best way to get over then is by attacking the very integrity and humanity of the black community. And it means then that this attack on the humanity and the integrity of the black community must proceed even at the time when some blacks appear to be making it up in the system. It means that you must even use those blacks who are making it up in the system to join you in the attack on themselves. This is one of the underlying causes. This is one of the preconditions that was there when the LA insurrection occurred. If you'll read the current Atlantic magazine, which seems to revel in the analysis of African people, they will talk in this current month about the suburban century. They call it the suburban century begins. And what do they mean by that? They're referring to the fact now that the political base of this country lies in the suburban areas. And for the first time in the history of this country, it's the suburbs who carry the weight in terms of votes. It is no longer the large cities which carry the larger percentage of voters. And consequently then, politicians who expect to get elected to office must speak to the suburbs and must cajole those and flatter those who live there. This is why then you're hearing again and again about this neglected middle class, you see, and programs that concern themselves with rehabilitating and restoring the middle class. Another code for we are going to ignore these blacks whom we have locked into these inner cities. And we are not now going to propose any kind of programs for them. We are now going to propose that you're the ones that are in trouble. And we now are going to rescue you from your troubles. You'll look in many of the publications today talking about edge cities. New cities created principally by whites that ring the inner cities. Cities that now, whose governments are almost under direct control of these white suburbanites. Cities then that have influence in state governments in such a way that they can prevent taxation schemes that are meant to rescue the inner cities, that are meant to change the direction of the miseducation of our children, that are meant to relieve the problems of the inner cities. We have a situation then where whites have organized themselves in such a way that a politician who even talks about the rescue of the cities is literally damned for state office or for higher office. And now you see Clinton and other groups speaking to this suburban fringe. Is this fringe suffering? They tend to think that the black community, implicitly or explicitly, is not aware of what is going on. Let's look at some of these things, some of these preconditions. By 1991, the federal government's largest housing subsidy program was providing an average of $3,000 a year for each of 6 million wealthiest households in America, while offering nothing to the 36 million Americans in poverty. Only one of every 8 federal benefit dollars actually reaches Americans in poverty. There has been a wholesale rape and robbery of the poor and weak in this country. And yet, this is the class that is supposedly now being rescued and is now supposedly being ministered unto by those who run for office. From 1980 to 1991, in constant dollars, the average federal benefit received by households with incomes under $10,000 declined by 7%. An actual decrease in benefits from the government, but yet we get a lying and deceptive image that because of the fiscal difficulties in this country are those people on welfare, of the burden placed upon the government and upon the treasury by the poor people and by inner city people. And yet these people earning under $10,000 have actually had their monies taken away and not added on to, while the rich and while the middle class have actually fed at the government troughs. On average, households with incomes under $10,000 collected a total of $5,690 in benefits. On average, households with incomes over $100,000 collected $9,280 from the government. In other words, those making over $100,000 collect nearly twice as much from the government as those earning under 10. You see, you'll hear whites in making these discussions and talking about the state of this country and talking about the debt that this country is suffering from. And you can hear them talk about the deficit and the threat that this deficit holds for the health of this nation. And I want to warn you that this nation is in a very precarious state of circumstances. And the precariousness of its state will be made clear after the elections. But if you listen carefully, you can already feel the panic over the concerns of the economic state of this country. They are in such a panic that they know they have to reduce the deficit of this nation if it is to survive and if it is going to be socially viable. In my series on power, I talk about one of the causes of black-on-black violence, other than the psychology that I referred to earlier, other than the social relations, has to do with the economic state of the black community. I try to emphasize that it's very important from a conceptual point of view to think in terms of a nation within a nation when it comes to analyzing black problems. I am not advocating that you buy the concept that we should have a nation within a nation. So don't give me a knee-jerk reaction right on. What I am saying is just think conceptually in terms of black people as a nation within a nation. I think when you use this concept, it will help you to see some things that perhaps you cannot see through the use of other concepts, such as individualism and the other stuff that people lay on you. When you look at the black community and the African-American community in this country as a nation within a nation, it becomes almost immediately apparent as to why there's so much violence and social disorganization in the black community. I often use the Chinese Opium Wars to illustrate what I'm talking about, of how the British, in entering trade with the Chinese, were buying all of their tea from China, and China was buying nothing from the British. The British had nothing the Chinese wanted. And yet the British wanted that tea. They were hooked on a tea habit. And the Chinese demanded only silver and gold from the British. And that meant over time that the British balance of payments became unbalanced because her silver and gold was flowing into China, but nothing, no earnings were coming back from the Chinese, and they were facing a dilemma. They recognized that this situation could not continue or else they could not maintain their social institutions and they could not maintain social order in their society and that their government could not maintain legitimacy and the people at some point would rise up against it in revolt and refuse to follow its dictates and refuse to pledge allegiance to it and destroy it. Because this is what happens to nations when they have negative flows of wealth. Because it takes wealth to maintain order. It takes wealth to maintain institutions. It takes wealth to maintain employment system. It takes wealth to create jobs. It takes wealth to educate children and so forth. And when that wealth is flowing out into the hands of other people, these institutions collapse. The discipline of the people collapse. The obedience and the habits of obedience collapse, and chaos begins to reign. And the only way governments can maintain power then under those circumstances is often to use martial law and strong martial means of maintaining population control. And that has serious limitations. And the British then recognized that we had to change the situation or else our very society will be destroyed. And what did they do then? They hooked the Chinese into an opium habit and started and addicted the Chinese and then demanded of the Chinese once they got hooked, now you pay us for your opium in silver and gold. And that habit got to such a level that the balance was reversed. And the flow went out of China to England. And when the Chinese tried to stop it, the English government, the old pusher that it is, yes, a government based on drugs. The Queen, the greatest drug pusher the world has ever known, went in like any gangster on these streets out here to protect their monopoly to sell drugs to the Chinese. And engaged in two wars to maintain the drug market that they had established. And yet you try to sit here and listen to these jokers with their moral pieties try to talk to us. Nation built upon the selling of drugs and the government coming in defense of the selling of drugs. But my point here is, of course, what happens when you get trade imbalances. And the Chinese recognize if we don't stop this stuff, our wealth is going to flow out to such a degree until we then will suffer social collapse. Now, when you look then at the African-American communities, surrounded by non-African communities, plagued by economic parasites, coming into its midst and taking its wealth and earnings right out, exploited by white and non-white alike, who rob it of its wealth and rob it of its resources, and who, even in its stupidity, tries to say the answer to this is to increase the number of us with skills and education, only to have those with increased skills and education also what? Shipped out so that they can solve other people's problems and spend their earnings in other people's markets and therefore can't return neither their skills